Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I am conducting an exclusive interview with Don Burke, top international communications consultant and speaker coach. Don shares his deep insights on effective speaking, managing stage fright, using graphics and media, employing a collaborative style, handling questions and answers, plus Don shares his career lessons for success. Don, you know, you have this amazing background and really quite a remarkable history of success and effective communications. So I really appreciate you coming in to do this interview, and in fact, we're very fortunate. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's my pleasure. And honestly, I'm honored to be included among the leaders you've already interviewed.
Don, I was looking at your background, and it just blew the socks off. You know, and I was just saying, wow. Can you discuss then some of your prior roles and maybe some lessons that you can pass on to the audience?
Sure. You know, the way you describe it, I guess, Stephen, what I've done is taken sort of the scenic route, so to speak. And I've had a lot of prior roles. And often what has happened in my life is I've switched careers when something new fascinated me. I didn't even know this was in the background, but I was an actor, singer, yoga teacher, artist, and then I was a writer, producer, director of video. Led me into communications consultant and a speaker coach. And I guess if there's a common theme around all those things, it was around performance. So if you want me to talk about the roles, if I may, just for fun, I'd like to go way back to maybe my first job and tie that into some other things. My very first job, the first money I earned, was as an 11-year-old. I taught myself chess and set up a little card table at a club, and mothers would bring their children over to me to teach them chess. I was competing in the Correspondence Chess League of America. You know, 11 years old, I remember I was playing one fellow from Florida who was 97 years old. And even then, what fascinated me most about the game wasn't the win or lose, it was the process. And I sort of saw it as a competitive dance. We were competing for space on the board. And years later, I became a competitive squash player. I stopped doing that when I had children. Had two daughters, Emily and Julia, and eventually they became competitive figure skaters. And my wife said, you know, the girls really should see you compete. And so what I did was got back in shape, played some tournaments, qualified for nationals, and here I am at Yale playing in the nationals, my daughters watching me. And I won a few matches and came up against a pro who actually won the tournament. Don't know, it was either the semis or the quarters. And after losing that match, came off the court, and I said, what do you think, girls? And my older one, Emily, said, Dad, you had more fun losing than you did in the matches you won. And I said, of course, it was the best match I played. And I had always talked to them about relishing the moment, being present. It was the journey that mattered, not the result. If you have a great journey, the results are going to follow. And it was great to see them learn the lesson of honoring the process. So that might be one of the lessons that I would put out there. Working in the theater as an actor, singer, connecting and opening up to the audience to touch them. Lesson, I guess, being open. Just the opposite when I was an artist working as a painter and a video artist and a sculptor, working in isolation and there, again, being in the moment, being very present. As a director, I got a reputation for pulling performances out of executives that I interviewed. And I guess the reason that I was able to do that was that I found something to like and admire in every subject. And they felt that, and they opened up to me. And I guess the lesson is to see the person. As a creative director, I was successful at bringing sides together, stimulating creativity. And the lesson there is to listen and find consensus. I guess there's a common lesson, Stephen. And the common lesson is something that Richard Alpert, who later became Baba Ram Dass, titled his book, Be Here Now. And it's all about being in the present. A lot of it's listening and being open. And as a communications consultant and speaker coach, I do a lot of collaborating with my subject. It's not my way. We collaborate to help each person discover his or her strengths. And when you're in the present moment, when you're doing that, you have a lot of fun. And I think you have to have a lot of fun to have a great result.
You know, it's really interesting. You're talking about process and being open and listen and collaborating and being in the present. It kind of reminds me of Eckhart Tolle's work, right? You know, the New Earth and so on. Do you make use of social media then?
I've gotten into it a little bit lately. Haven't done it a whole lot. Everyone's telling me that I should, and haven't used it as much as I probably should. So certainly not an expert there. I have friends that use it constantly on Facebook. I signed up for Twitter just to see what someone was tweeting about a basketball game when she was in the huddle. So no, I don't yet. I use Facebook, but not a big social media person, although that's something that I'm looking into.
So Have you shared your views recently in a book?
I have not.
Or I'm just thinking maybe a YouTube video or a series.
No, it's interesting. The thing about that is that while I love what I do, and the truth is I've never actually had a job that I didn't love doing except the job of looking for more jobs. And have I shared my views? I share my views with my students, certainly, but I haven't put it into any formal thing, which is something that I'm thinking of doing.
You've done a lot, and in your prior roles, you must have come up against some barriers or challenges. Can you talk about that and what you weren't able to overcome and perhaps what you would do differently now?
Sure. One that sticks out in my mind was there was a reshuffling when I was working at some company, and I was placed under the wing of the person who ran the website. And she tasked me with creating new areas of interest on the web. And each time that I would come to her with a project, an idea, she would get very enthusiastic. Gee, this is a terrific idea, Don. I love it. I love it so much that I want to do it with you. And needless to say, she never seemed to find the time to do it with me. It was very frustrating. And during one presentation, I happened to offhandedly mention that I saw another company that had done something similar very successfully. And suddenly, although she was still too busy to join in with me, I got the go-ahead. And after that, I always gave her examples of a success with my proposal, someone else who had done it. And I didn't really understand it at the time, but later I came to understand that there are five kinds of decision makers: charismatics, skeptics, thinkers, followers, and controllers. I should have known earlier that her decision making type was follower. Now, follower is not a pejorative, it's not a personality, it's not a judgment. A follower is a good corporate citizen, they're cautious, brand driven, look for the safest solution. In fact, 36% of decision makers are followers, the largest group. And the key for them is to show them that it works for others. They need a safety net. So now whenever I present something, I look for clues to figure out what motivates that decision maker so I can give him or her what they need.
That brings up a question, then. What are some of the clues for the different kinds of decision makers?
Sure. As I said, there were five, and I got this from a book, but one of the types are, I mentioned followers first. Followers are, as I said, good corporate citizens. They let others pave the path, take the risk. They're comfortable doing what they're told and delegating. So if something failed in the past, it's going to be very difficult to get it to work now. You have to keep things simple for them. They need to feel that they're making the right decision. They don't want the best decision. They want the safest decision. And you just have to watch them to see if this is the kind of thing that works for them. An example of a follower might be Carly Fiorino. When she was, you know, running HP, she was that kind of a person. A controller, and this is a small group, but they're meticulous micromanagers. They have strong personalities. They're opinionated. They want facts from an expert. One of the things that you want there is to get someone to validate who you are as you present things to them. An example of a micromanager, perfectionist, this controller, would be Ross Perot, for instance. A thinker, Bill Gates, Michael Dell are thinkers. They want all the plot points. They want absolutely every bit of detail so they can figure things out for themselves. They're the toughest, by the way, to persuade. They have a strong aversion to risk, and they're very slow to decide. Skeptics are rebels. They question everything because they think they're right. Ted Turner's an example there. They need credibility to persuade. They rely on their gut feelings. And charismatics, a lot of people think they're charismatics. Jack Welch is an example of a charismatic. They're big picture, bottom line people. They're bored with long pitches. You have to give them the bottom line first. And it's a matter of observing these people, trying to figure out just which they fit into. Again, not which personality they fit into, but which type of decision maker they are.
I see. It sounds like you could use this in working with not only clients and customers and so on, but students working in the family itself.
True, true. And in fact, you know, when I talk about communications and being a better speaker, I think that it helps people not only succeed in business, but in their life as well. You know, just even sitting around the dinner table trying to convince the family what movie we should see to make that persuasive argument. And it's a recipe for success in life. You would ask for a few. One of those lessons was the 80-20 rule, which as a journalist means getting it in on time. That's the 80%. Just getting it in on time. It can be, the 20% can be great. It can be a fabulous piece. But if it's not there in time to be published, it doesn't matter. And when I was writing for a sports publication in New York City, I was always rushing to get that done at the last minute. But the lesson is really driven home to me. Again, playing squash, I was playing for my club against the Harvard club in the city championships, and I was playing the deciding match. And I was just playing great on this particular day. And I was having so much fun playing that I began playing cat and mouse. And as often is the case in sports, you see someone play down to the competition or up to the competition. To keep the game going, I began to play down, he began to play up, and you can guess what happened. I lost the match. My team lost the title, which is really what hurt most. And ever since then, the book on beating me was to lose the first game to Don. And that 80-20 rule is one that is a lesson that I learned. You know, keep the eye on the bottom line.
So what are some key disruptive forces driving change in your life? And again, how can we learn from your experiences?
I guess one of the disruptive forces is probably doubt. And when I say doubt, I don't mean doubt about my abilities, but about my career direction. Ever since my mother told me repeatedly as a child that I should be a doctor, through life, I always worry that I went from one interest to another, not on a straight course, pillar to post, so to speak. But as time went by, I guess I'm being a little philosophical, I saw that there was a direction. Each experience was a different color on a widening palette. You don't have blinders on. Trust your instinct. Don't let yourself be what other people think you should be, because we're all, each of us, always a work in progress as long as we're living. So that was a disruptive force, I guess, doubting where I was going and, you know, trust your instincts.
In your current roles, what are your biggest challenges and their solutions?
Well, one of the companies I'm working with is a high-tech company, and I help them prepare their information to the public, primarily the investing community. And the two people that I work with are the president, CEO, and the chairman. And the president is an engineer. He's very conservative, wants to talk about absolute truths, and this is what we're doing, this is what we can do. And the chairman is from the financial background, and he wants to talk about what might happen in the future and how rosy things are. And each wants something completely different out of the public materials, and they make each other uncomfortable. But the truth is they share a common goal and a vision for the company. And what I'm working there is to make them see that they have this common goal. They're not making promises. They're excited about prospects and potential, and they present together. So I've got to make them see that and play off of each other. As far as coaching speakers, I guess the biggest challenge is probably overcoming the fear in students. And we all know about fear of public speaking, but there's also a fear of even learning to speak well. And most of the people that I work with, the first day that they walk in, they're really nervous. They're anxious. They don't want to be doing this. It's very uncomfortable. And, you know, I have to make it fun. I have to get them to enjoy themselves because it opens them up to learning as well. And the goal is to make the speaker's message matter and have fun at that. So overcoming that fear is a challenge, but not a hard one, and a lot of fun. Current roles, I'm a local politician. And I brought an environmental initiative to the town government, and it was stalled by my opponent, who I eventually ran against for political office, and he didn't want me to, even though it seemed to be a no-brainer of an initiative, a green initiative, he defeated it because he didn't want that feather in my cap. So one of the things I learned there is be sure of your support for an agenda. It's not just going to succeed because it's the right thing, but you have to get support, see other perspectives before you move it forward. So you have to prepare before you do those things.
I guess a takeaway, too, is it sounds like, you know, what you've learned is that those elements of finding that common element that people can share are sort of the roots of negotiations in general.
Absolutely. Well said.
So I'm just thinking of your Congress, right? And just sort of these two opposing sides, and, you know, hopefully there'll be some common ground.
It is very frustrating. And again, it seems that the bottom line for, you know, without getting too partisan, I think the bottom line for too many people in Congress right now is what's going to be politically expedient for them, not what's best for the people they're supposed to be serving.
You know, early in your response, you talked about, you know, just working with people and speaking and so on. So let's delve into that further. You know, you are a top international authority in communications. So in these series of questions here, I'll just sort of focus in that area.
Sure.
So what are the most important traits of an effective speaker?
I've been asked that one before, and I remember the first time that I was asked that, it was so easy. The most important trait of an effective speaker is one word, attitude. And I've seen great speakers with all the wrong mechanics. They did the wrong things, but they were great speakers because of their attitude. They were having a ball. They let the audience know there's nothing they'd rather be doing than speaking with that audience. As a host, they welcome the audience in and have just an absolutely great time. Jean Giraudoux, the French playwright, said, "The secret of success is sincerity. Once you can fake that, you got it made." So I'm not serious about that, but you've got to relax and enjoy yourself up there. And once you're relaxed and enjoying yourself, the audience is going to follow suit and they'll be open to receiving what you're saying.
I guess you're saying that if you're passionate, it's infectious.
Absolutely. And not just passionate, but enjoying sharing that information. You can be passionate about something negative, and that can work for some, but when you're sharing information, which most of us find ourselves doing, and you are passionate and care and enjoying the sharing of that, the audience is going to be much more open to receiving it.
So I guess a sort of a related question is then, how does a speaker handle stage fright?
Well, stage fright, first of all, I want to say that stage fright is not all bad. I think if someone goes up on the stage and has no anxiety, they're probably going to give a flat performance. And there are performers who charge themselves, who work at making themselves anxious so they can give that good, exciting performance. It charges your batteries. And most of us don't have that problem. Most of us have to rein it in. And so I work with the people that are my speakers in four ways to control that. And the first way is physical being deep breathing. So you want to relax. And I've had people come up to me before presentations and say, "Don, I really feel nervous. What should I do?" I said, "Okay, take a deep breath." And they go, and I say, "No, that's not a deep breath. A deep breath is about the exhale. And that's really key. Nature abhors a vacuum and is going to fill your lungs after you've emptied it. And so the key to deep breathing is to breathe out sort of like, feel yourself relax around that sigh. If you're going to do it audibly like I just did, make sure that the mic is off when you do that. So the physical is the first way to deal with that. Just breathe out, relax, feel yourself relax around that. The second way is intellectual. Remind yourself, why are you the speaker? You're the speaker because you're the expert. And this is going to instill confidence in you. These people are here to learn from you. They're here for your message. Just never forget, you know, some people get up on the stage and they think everyone's judging them. No, no, no. They're here because they want to learn. Third way, emotional. Occasionally I'll find myself speaking and I'll put a couple pictures of my daughters on the lectern in front of me. And when I look out at the audience, I'll see them there. And I'll start talking to Emily or Julia in the audience. And what it does is warm me, it centers me, and I've had people come up to me after presentations and say, "Don, you know, I just felt that you really cared about us." And it's true, I did, but what helped me communicate that was the fact that I was really talking to my daughters as I delivered this information. Now, again, these are guidelines that have to work for you, and I remember working with an analyst, Gartner, and I said, he was anxious, and I said, "You know what? Picture your daughter in the audience. Talk to her." And he said, "You know, I have a 16-year-old daughter, and talking to my daughter does not relax me." Well, if that's the case, find somebody who does. It might be a mate, a good friend, but if you talk to that person and feel it relax you and center you, you're going to get positive results. One more thing that I find works very effectively is to list your assets. And this is sort of a private exercise that I have people in workshops do. What I have them do is write on an index card or a slip of paper the things that you like about yourself and the things that others like about you. And it's a positive assessment, and it's absolutely private. Show it to no one else. And the reason I say that is that if you're going to show it to other people, false modesty is going to get in there. You want this to be an honest, positive assessment. Positive, I stress. Because when you're feeling anxious and you're about to go up on the stage, you pull this out, look at it, and it's going to make you smile. It's going to make you feel good about yourself. And that's going to help you combat that stage fright, that anxiety that everyone should feel a little bit of when they walk up on the stage.
So I'm just thinking in my mind, you've given us a tremendous pile of hints, you know, the physical, the intellectual, the list, and the emotional. And I think those are very useful hints.
Thanks. I've used all of them, and a lot of people have. I recall doing it with a woman once at Gartner's symposium. She was just feeling really anxious, and I talked to her about that, looking at the person that you care about. And her brother-in-law was actually at attending symposium. She was presenting. He was in a different room. There was something that he had to hear that she wasn't presenting, so he wasn't there to hear her. But as she looked out in the audience, she saw him there in her mind, and she said, "I've just never felt so good during a presentation."
You know, you see a lot of technology being used today, and this has got to impact presentations in some fashion. So, what are the best ways to use graphics and media in a presentation?
Well, let's talk about graphics first. 75% of our information comes to us visually. So a graphic is going to help the audience remember things. Interestingly, when I came to Gartner, I was their creative director for a little over 7 years. When I arrived there, they were doing presentations where the presenter would stand up on the stage and say, "Okay, ladies and gentlemen, open your book to page 46 and we'll begin." And 1,000 heads would drop into a book, and he would talk to the tops of 1,000 heads. And I said, "Oh my gosh, people won't even watch the news unless they're being entertained. Let's put some visuals up there." And so I began to institute graphics for them. A graphic is going to help the audience remember. But with that, you have to fight, because most of our audience, I'm sure, is dealing with a lot of data. And there's always that tendency to put up too much material. One of the guidelines here is just less is more. The acronym KISS, keep it simple, stupid, because the audience is going to read what you put up on the screen, whether it's a chart or bullet points. They're going to read that, and you can't compete with it. If you put too much up there, instead of that visual support supporting you, you become support for the visual because you're going to have to explain it. And one more thought about graphics. Never use three dimensions to illustrate two dimensions because it obscures your point. A lot of people think it looks fancy, but it's one of the ways that you can actually lie with statistics. Whenever I see 3D to illustrate 2D, I think, what is this person hiding? That's the graphic part of it. Media, the first rule there is be relevant. You have to be relevant. It can be a refreshing break for the audience, especially in something that's very data heavy. And it could also be a break for you too. I'll tell you a story. A woman came to me and she said she wanted to do a video for a presentation. She was doing a presentation on asset management. And said, "Tell me about the presentation." And she was saying, well, this is back in the mid-90s. And she said that, you know, contracts for mainframes are very onerous and complex for desktops. They're very simple. They don't matter. And now there's this merging of desktop and mainframe. And it's like the mouse has become a monster. I said, what a great image. And I did this very simple video where you see a hand on a mouse, and the mouse becomes a live mouse. Very simple. Well, the audience howled. Now, I have to tell you, it wasn't that funny. It wasn't really that funny. But the audience had been there for days of really dense, valuable material, and when something light was introduced to them, it was such a relief that they were slapping their knees, having the greatest time. And as she continued with the presentation after that, they were refreshed and able to absorb what she was saying. The other side of that is that while she was showing that video, no one was looking at her. For all intents and purposes, she had gotten off the stage, although she was still up there. And she was able to take a deep breath. She was able to relax, refocus, and recharge herself and come back with renewed energy. So I love using media. It has to be relevant. It can't be gratuitous. But if it is relevant, it can be a big boost to a presentation.
Earlier in this discussion, you talked about collaboration and, you know, the process, opening, listening, being present and collaborating. Well, with regards to speaking then, can you comment on using a collaborative style?
Sure. Let's talk about two types of collaboration. You can collaborate with the audience. That involves asking questions of the audience or having them ask questions of you. That it's great at keeping the audience involved in your presentation. One warning, if you ask the audience a question where you're looking for an answer, like how many people have done such and such, give the audience the answer that you see. For instance, how many of you have driven more than 20 miles to get here today? Oh, that's interesting. Okay, let me ask another question. Well, now what's happened is everyone in the audience is looking around trying to figure how many people did that. So you want to give them the answer, keep everyone on the same page when you do ask a question like that. But when we're talking about collaboration, I suspect you mean collaborating with a presenting partner. And there, the most important rule for that is when your partner is speaking, you want to be still and pay attention, because physical movement is going to trump sound every time. If you're moving around and your partner's talking, people are going to be looking over at you. So pay attention. There were a couple of analysts who were, I recall, presenting a presentation, and they wanted to do a point-counterpoint where they each took different sides of an issue and wanted to do it in a different way. And what I had them do was I had one person stand up on the stage and say, good afternoon, I'd like to apologize for my partner not being here, but I'd like to present my views on this subject. And he began presenting them. And after he had gotten into it, his partner, who was sitting in the front row, jumped up and said, you just don't see this issue at all. You can't even see me sitting in the front row. And he jumped up on the stage, and the two of them began bantering back and forth, and the audience just got a big hoot out of it. And like the video that I spoke about earlier, it was refreshing, it was memorable. It was the kind of thing that the audience enjoyed and was able to get more out of, because I think whenever you're having fun, you're learning more efficiently than when you're not.
You know, if maybe we can extend this question a bit. I'm just thinking that there's a lot, you know, if you attend a conference or there's a lot of presentations that are kind of panel-based where you have a moderator, and that moderator may do an initial presentation, and then you have a panel to discuss a theme. Now, I'm thinking that could be boring. How do you liven that up?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, you want to do a little planning beforehand when you do that. You want to know where each person stands. It's going to help, you know, you in your interchange with those people, but as if you're the moderator in a panel like that, you want to be prepared to, although it's sometimes rude, say, wait, you know, what you're saying seems to clash with what Stephen over here feels. Stephen, could you comment on that particular point? And I think to keep the tension of different points of view flowing is one of the things that can make a panel work very well. Not let one person go off ramble, and, you know, be prepared to rein that person in so that everyone has an opportunity to voice their points.
And maybe let's extend this even further. So imagine for a minute now, physically, you have this panel discussion occurring with world experts. You have a chair who's moderating that discussion. And then you have virtually people coming in from other parts of the world using some kind of video technology. What are some of the, you know, problems there?
Well, the problem there would be, you know, stepping on people's lines, and I think you sort of have to clear the way for the video presence. I know that I remember one year at the symposium, we had a panel of experts, and one of the luminaries that we had up there was not present, but came in via video. Bill Gates had just gotten back from a trip to China, wasn't able to be present. And I think all the other people thought, well, this is great. You know, I'm in a panel with Gates, and he's not even going to be here. I can overpower him. Unfortunately, he sent his people to our symposium to set up the video connection, and there was a huge screen behind them, and he towered over everyone on the stage. So his presence was very, very dominating. You know, I think that the thing is that, you know, it's not quite as real time as you would want it. And so I think the thing to worry about is keeping control so that people aren't constantly stepping on each other's lines.
There's a presentation occurs, and then there's that sort of, it could be an awful part, I guess, or it could be a very positive experience. And that's the question and answer portion. How do you handle that?
Well, let's talk about a few different ways to handle Q&A. If you're working in a relatively small group, I think the best way is to do it during the presentation, because it draws the whole audience in, makes the presentation approximate conversation, and I think it's the easiest way for most presenters. I think it's much easier to talk with an audience than talk to an audience, and it helps the audience pay attention as well. You can also do it at the end with a partner, and if you're doing that, the first thing that you have to remember is when the partner gathers up the questions on slips of paper, comes up onto the stage to ask them to you, introduce the partner. Don't let the audience wonder who this person is. And strategize with your partner. Maybe there's a particular area that you're insecure with, you don't want to discuss it. Maybe your partner can handle it. I would love to be able to say, when I'm up on the stage with a partner, you know, Stephen, I could answer that, but the truth is you're really the expert. I don't think there's anyone in the world who knows more about this than you do. Why don't you take that before me? Shows a lot of confidence and the depth and breadth of the organization. Like collaboration, pay attention. I've seen people up on the stage with questions in their hands, ask a question, and then begin rifling through the papers for the next question while the person's talking. Again, really distracting. But most of the questions are done at the end with one person on stage taking questions from the audience. And in this method and in the others that I've already mentioned, the biggest problem that I see most people have is that they answer the question to the person who's asked it. So you've got a whole audience there. You have to speak to the entire audience, not just let them be eavesdroppers in your private conversation. So take the question, if the audience can't hear it, repeat it, and start answering it to that questioner, but then look out and focus on other people in the audience. Bring them into it. Don't make it a private conversation. And you can end up speaking to the person who asked the question, and to make sure that you've answered it correctly, or not correctly, but satisfactorily. And occasionally you'll get a person who's up there to hear himself, and he'll try to bring this into a conversation and say, well, you know, I understand your point of view, but I think that if so-and-so, well, if that happens, you don't want to end on that person. So the next time they do that, you can begin, you can answer, and then as you move around to the rest of the audience, finish with someone else and say, yes, next question. If the person persists, ask them, let's take this offline so other people have an opportunity. So watch for that. But the big lesson there is speak to the whole audience, not just the person asking the question.
I guess I'm sort of left with this impression that it's not just about pushing communications, but pulling everybody in. And you do that through collaboration and engagement.
Absolutely. I may steal that and use that in one of my seminars.
You know, you have this extensive experience working with the top leaders worldwide, globally, driving their success. So what's your advice for handling time constraints?
Time constraints. You know, a lot of people want to pack too much into a presentation. And there was a time I assumed that going over time would make the audience feel that they got more for their money, but it's absolutely not true. You know, they have their schedule. If you haven't planned well enough for them, you feel like you're wasting their time. It's a little insulting. No one wants to hear, I just don't have enough time to finish all this. And even if you're at a conference where the next item on their agenda is going into the hallway for refreshments and chatting with their chums, they expect you, if you're doing 45 minutes of presentation and 15 minutes of Q&A, they expect to be out of there after that 15 minutes of Q&A. So the guideline is, practice, you know, practice with a watch. Know where you should be at all times so you have a sense of how the flow is going. And when you're up on the stage, obviously you don't want to be looking at your watch, because if you do that, they will too. Have a clock or something where you can reference your material, have some notes so you know where you should be at a certain point. You don't want to be halfway through with 10 minutes left and lose great material. You have to keep it timely. And one of the key things that I tell people is if you're still running late, be prepared to skim over some material that may be obvious or easily understood. And this would go into the construction of the presentation and say something like, you know, the several slides that I'm skimming over right now are pretty obvious. They're important, but you'll understand them. But there's something a little more complex toward the end that I'd like to spend some extra time on. Now what they're getting is not being cheated out of material, but they're getting a value add. So it's really important to be able to start and end on time. And don't feel that you have to put in everything that you know. You want to leave them wanting more.
You know, Don, we're sort of in the final sort of part of our discussion here, and I'm going to broaden the questions now. Can you talk about your predictions for future trends and their implications and opportunities?
Well, I don't think anything is ever going to beat good old-fashioned face-to-face, but as our lives get more and more complex, I think the biggest trend that we're going to see in the future is just more and more interactivity. You mentioned earlier about pulling in remote experts. We're going to see that, but it's getting easier and easier to do that, and so we're going to see it more and more often. I think visuals are going to become more sophisticated and more interactive, so we'll be able to manipulate those as we're presenting. A lot of people use surveys while they're presenting by giving out handheld objects. I think that cell phones are probably going to take the place of that, making that even easier to do. And the thing that I'm looking forward to in the future, don't know how far off it is, but I expect holographic instead of video on stage, holographic interaction with someone remote. And that's something that I'm really looking forward to.
What would be your top recommended resources and why?
I mentioned earlier the five types of decision makers. And I got that from Miller and Williams, a book called The Five Paths to Persuasion, The Art of Selling Your Message. And in this, they interviewed 1,600 executives on how they made decisions by weighing risk and responsibility. And it gives insight into how to sell an idea to a particular decision maker. But mostly, I think I advise people to watch, study the speakers that they admire and who resonate with them. Coaches, teachers, politicians, preachers, entertainers. Pay attention. When you like these people, what is it about them that really attract you? And is there something you can borrow? And when I say admire and resonate is key. For instance, I think Robin Williams is a brilliant comic. He cracks me up. Love what he does. There's nothing that he does that I can borrow. I am nothing like Robin Williams. And so while he entertains me, I'm not going to look to borrow anything from him. Chris Rock, another brilliant comic, there's something about the way he patters, the way that he rhythmically sets something up. Gee, I can borrow a little bit of that. So, you know, look for these people that you admire and see if anything resonates with right there.
You know, those are some great recommendations, and I know that the audience is going to delve into them further and take your lessons and experiences, because you are this, you know, top international consultant and communications expert. Now, you know, here's a sort of a question that may be a little bit off, a little bit to the side, but in a way it also has to do with communications as well. You know, there's this International Federation for Information Processing. They're a UN-founded body, an official UNESCO consultative body. And for the first time, they're launching this sort of concept called IP3, which is creating a profession out of IT with global standards, global certification, universal mobility. Countries are involved now. And this is an historical inflection point. It's never happened before. And you've been touching with IT for a number of years, and you know that this has always been a big question. What do you think of this, creating a profession out of IT?
I think it's a great idea. And, you know, let me add a disclaimer. I'm not an expert here, Stephen. I'm the communications person, and these are the IT people, although I work with them a lot. I know it's been tried before, reappears periodically. I'm glad that there's another push on for it. I hope that it actually happens before some company loses billions on it and goes to court over some self-made programmer's advice. Love to see it happen, and I wish you all the best luck with it.
In your many sort of roles that you've had and continue to take on, you have this great opportunity to engage with people from all, you know, all over the world. And so you must have some stories to share, you know, maybe something surprising or unexpected, amazing from your work.
Lots of stories. Here's one that I remember. I was in Brisbane, and one of the things that I did when I was with Gartner was set up a rehearsal room where I would work with people that I either had worked with earlier or they had been remote and hadn't had a chance to really work with them. And I had someone come running in. At the time, Gartner was divided into the main Gartner, which dealt with the end user, and the DataQuest part of Gartner, which dealt with the vendors. And this was a DataQuest analyst. She was being asked to present to an audience of end users. She'd never done this before, and she was in a panic. And so what I had her do was walk out on the stage and turn to the approximately 600 people in the audience and say, "Shh, today you are a corporate spy at a vendor briefing." And she began presenting what she would normally do at a vendor briefing, gave her normal presentation. The audience was thrilled. They had a wonderful time, eavesdropping on something that they had never been able to hear before. And that was just a lot of fun. Here's a funny one. One of our analysts was presenting in Israel. Now, they're understanding the culture is really important, and every culture has different things. And I guess people in Israel are very fond of multitasking. And this presenter was talking to the audience, and he was getting very annoyed because he would see people in the audience quietly talking on their cell phones. They didn't consider it rude. No one else did, but he thought it was awful. Following day, he arranged to have someone call him while he was on stage. His phone rang. He looked at the audience and said, "Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me, I'm going to take this call." Turned his back on the audience and carried on a short conversation, thinking this will show them how rude it is. No one in the audience thought it was rude. They thought, "Oh, this is an opportunity for me to make that call that I wanted to." And when he turned back to the audience, everybody was on their phone. So it's important to understand the culture. Another time I was interviewing the executive vice president of a large IT company. And as we were doing it, I paused in the interview and I said, "You know, what you're telling me is really good news." "Yes, it is." I said, "How about a smile?" And he looked me dead in the eye and said, "I am smiling." I asked the cameraman and the engineer to leave the room, and the two of us began just chatting away, telling each other jokes until we were both laughing, and then I had them come back in, and I was able to finish the interview with a lot more positive feeling.
You know, I just have a big smile on my face. Those are great stories.
Oh, here's one more that This is sort of one of my personal favorites. I was doing a Red Cross blood drive video, and it played in corporations all across America. And AT&T was the corporate sponsor for this. And because of that, they asked me to interview four of their people whose lives had been saved with blood transfusions. And I had shot a lot of it by the time it came to interviewing those people, and I had left four holes into which I would insert those interviews. And the day of the shoot, only three of the four showed up. Well, it just so happens that at one time I had some sinus surgery and needed a transfusion. And so I filled in for that spot and stepped into the fray. And I actually had to interview myself, not normally Hitchcock inserting myself into the thing, but it was a lot of fun. But the funny part was, and sort of touching for me, was that I started hearing months after that from people that I hadn't spoken to since grade school. You know, I would get calls and, Don, this is Henry. I'm living in California now. I just saw you in this video. Are you okay? Unbelievable how you almost died. It was a real touching experience for me.
You know, those are just amazing. And thank you for sharing those. You know, I have this one final part here, and I'm thinking this common theme that you have is about collaboration and not just to push out communications, but to pull people in to engage them. And that's a principle. So you know what? We're going to apply this to the interview. Rather than me pushing out the questions, I'm going to engage you. We're going to collaborate. What questions would you have asked, which I didn't ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, first of all, you've done a great job. I mean, you've asked a lot of wonderful questions. And maybe I've touched on this a little bit, but I guess my question might be, what is the most important part of the presentation? And the answer to that is the opening. We've all heard people say that first impressions are the longest lasting, and it is so true in a presentation. And there was a study done by a Harvard experimental psychologist, Nalini Ambati, and what she did was record 10 seconds of tape of Harvard professors presenting on the first day to their students. Well, she had video problems, and she only was able to capture 2 seconds of video with no sound. She went ahead with the experiment, and she showed those 2-second clips to hundreds of students who didn't have the professors and tracked 15 traits. And she compared it to the impressions of the students answering the same questions who were in that class for an entire semester. And all 15 traits tracked. So her conclusion from that wasn't that everyone got the right impression immediately, but that the first impression stuck. And she called it the fundamental attribution error. And what she's saying is you might be wrong, but that first impression is so important that you've got to make use of it. Tricia Prickett was an undergrad at the University of Toledo. She did a similar experience that she called the handshake is everything. And she showed an applicant walking in for a job, come in, shake hands, sit down, welcomed by the interviewer. People who watched it were generally able to pick out who was hired. Again, a fundamental attribution error. So it's important to know how to make it count, take advantage of it. And I guess, you know, greeting people in their native language is one way. Making eye contact is very key. And that's one of the things I work on a lot. Making eye, even if you can't see the audience because you're in a spotlight and they're in the dark, pick focus points and talk to those people. They'll be drawn to you. Open with a joke. If you're not the kind of person that tells jokes normally, don't try to be something you're not. Maybe tell a story. But the most important thing is enjoy yourself, because most, for the most part, the people attending really want you to succeed. So that's one question I might have asked myself. Another one might be, how do you keep it from being another boring lecture? What have you done to spice things up? And I remember one of my buddies at Gartner was opening a new division on collaborative technology. And he said, this is our first conference. I'd like to open with a splash. Could you do a video for me? And I said, well, Bruce, you know, I love videos, but I can't think of anything less collaborative than having the audience sit on their hands and watch a video. Tell me about your keynote. And he talked about it, and he said, I'm going to be talking about the different tracks. There's collaborative engineering, and as he told me the different tracks, I came up with this idea. And so here he is presenting to the audience, and he throws up a chart, and he says, one of the tracks that you might want to follow during this week is on collaborative engineering. And suddenly, from the back of the audience, 500 or so people sitting there, someone yells, excuse me, I don't want to be rude, but I know that slide is going to confuse the people. Bruce says, who are you? He says, Henry Jimenez. I've done a lot of work in collaborative engineering. You're just going to confuse the people. And Bruce said, would you like to come up and discuss it? And he jumps out of his seat and begins walking down the aisle. And And the audience was shocked. In fact, the ushers at the hotel where this was, when they were in London, came running in and grabbed the guy. And Bruce said, no, no, ever the gracious host. No, I invited him up here, please. He's one of he's my guest. He came up on the stage and pointed to the slide, and he said, well, you see, if the Phoebus does the Phorbus, and Bruce said, well, you know, what you're saying makes a lot of sense. And they began to collaborate. This is the collaborative IT conference. They began to collaborate, and the audience was watching it firsthand. And as they were doing this, the guy feeling very full of himself, and of course, he's really the guy who is leading the track. The audience doesn't know this yet. Feeling very full of himself, he says, Bruce, can I have the next slide? Bruce pulls up the next slide. He says, well, collaborative commerce. Haven't done a lot of this, but I'll take a stab at it. And Bruce said, no, you've been terrific. Let's give him a hand. Maybe someone else wants to talk about it. And a woman jumps up and says, I'd be glad to talk about it. I've done lots of work in collaborative commerce. And she and the audience begins to get it at this point that, and Bruce does eventually introduce, these are the people who will be leading these tracks that you might be interested in. But it was one of those things where the audience was just blown away and you know, went back after the conference was over talking about how they were, you know, involved in the show. Creating those kinds of things is one of the real fun things that I've been able to do in my life.
Sounds like you'd have a series of best practices of things that work because you have this rich experience.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and you know, openings, closings, how to do those things properly are, you know, all part of making a presentation work well. It's just a lot of fun to do.
Well, Don, you know, it's been a marvelous journey today. You shared so many insights, and I know they're going to be of such great value. So thank you for coming in. And I know your schedule is very tight, and you know, I'm very appreciative that you took the time to share these experiences, all of that accumulated wisdom that you have with our audience.
Well, Stephen, it's been a ball for me chatting with you. And, you know, being asked these questions has reminded me of some things that I hadn't thought about in a long time. So it's totally my pleasure. Thank you very much.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Don Burke, top international communications consultant and speaker coach. Don shared his deep insights on effective speaking, managing stage fright, using graphics and media, employing a collaborative style, handling questions and answers, plus Don shared his career lessons.